Hello, good people, and welcome to the Alchemy of Light broadcast. Today, we are broadcasting here in planet Earth. It is a beautiful day. This is the program slotted for October the 6th, 2012, the 29th day of the 10th lunation. And we are here with a very special guest today in this auspicious weekend that in America is called the Columbus Day celebration. And as we know, Columbus in the American mythology is told as the man who discovered America. And in actuality, he can be given credit for the beginning of an American idea. But on the ground, what the man was up to was a genocidal campaign of the Arawak Nation and the Bahamas, the island we now call Haiti, and the Dominican Republic. So with his memory and the continuing reality of the genocide that has continued, I am really, really honored at the Universal Love Intelligence for this opportunity to bring to you a very gifted human being, both in word and in the dignity of his soul, in bringing forward to all of us the current message of the indigenous people, which in fact is the message for all of us. Will you please welcome Reverend Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice, to the Alchemy of Light broadcast. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. And I would like to first, introduce people a little bit to the short version of your long story, beginning in 1992, when you became a priest in the United Church of Christ in Canada, and that began a journey for you that would change your life in Alberni, Canada. Is that correct?
That's right. That's on the west coast of Canada. Really, 20 years ago this month, I arrived there with my young family. And I first began to learn these stories from the Native people themselves, you know, the horrible crimes that had occurred in these church-run Indian boarding schools.
And will you please elaborate about how that happened? In your ministry, you noticed that there were not indigenous people present in your churches, as well there were few incorporated or integrated in positions you might call of respect within the town itself, though the population of the indigenous people was substantial. Will you please share a little bit about how you began to question that and where your trail ultimately led you to hearing their stories?
Yeah, well, I had had a long history working with poor people, people on the streets in Vancouver, as part of, you know, before I was ordained as a minister. I really carried that on when I got to Port Alberni. I opened a food bank in my church. There was Port Alberni as a logging town on Vancouver Island. It's got the worst standards of living in the province, British Columbia. So I began to go out and meet a lot of people, and that included a lot of Native people. They were about a third of the population. A lot of them were in very bad shape, like they still are. I began to ask questions about, you know, why that was, why there was such an enormous level of suffering in their community, you know, not just the obvious alcohol and drug addiction, but the destruction within the family, you know, massive poverty and unemployment. All of that had to be coming from somewhere. Well, none of the white people in town really wanted to talk about it. They got very uncomfortable when the topic came up. And one of the elders of my church actually told me the first week I was there in St. Andrew's United Church, right after my first sermon, he said, you know, the Indians keep to themselves, and we keep to ourselves, and everybody likes it that way. And that made me really curious, and I was called out to a Native home just in the first couple of weeks I was working there. And it was a man called Danny Gus. He was a retired Native fisherman, and I performed a wedding in his house. And after the service, I asked him why there were no Indians in any of the local white churches, and he finally said, after a lot of prompting, he finally said that his best friend had been killed in the United Church Indian boarding school, and it was literally a block away, the old building on the reservation. And he said that happened to a lot of those kids, and the whites know about it, and they don't want us in their churches. And, you know, literally every Native home I went into after that, I heard those stories. And that just went on and on. And you know, the truth, like still today, it's all over the place, but a lot of non-Native people just don't want to look at it.
In the conversation of the commonalities, let's fast forward in a way to the universality of the genocide. Your work took you from a very detailed exposure of the genocide and the complicity between church and state and the broad spectrum of it actually in Europe, and we can go all around the globe with that, continuing, you know, today. So share with us a little of your journey into connecting the dots to the universality of the genocide.
Well, you know, I'm actually glad you raised that, because it's where very much a lot of the work has been heading. And I learned over the years that, you know, something as simple as the fact that the laws that were brought in Canada aimed at Native people, like they had sterilization laws, were under the laws as far back as 1931. You could legally sterilize an Indian if they didn't go to church. If the principal of a residential school thought that kids were acting up, he would send them down to the local hospital. Or if he thought they were too intelligent, they would get a little red tag, they'd report to the clinic and get sterilized. Well, I mean, those laws are all over the world. They were brought in during the same period of time. Hitler just acted on a lot of stuff that had already been going on in North America, you know, the eugenics laws aimed at all sorts of groups in society, including Native people. And so, you know, after a while I realized, this wasn't just happening in Indians. There was a definite campaign for centuries, and the churches were very much a part of this, saying that there's all sorts of groups in society that are supposedly inferior. We have the right to exterminate them, conduct wars against them, take their land. And as I often say to people, this happened against my own ancestors in Europe. And many of us are in North America, here in Turtle Island, as the natives call the continent. We're here because it happened to our families. We're driven out of Europe. And then, ironically, we come over and start doing it to the Native people here, not realizing that we're just acting out that, you know, that that pathology of the abused becoming abusers. And this is why I think the work now is very important spiritually, because it's a way for us to look in the mirror, stop talking about, you know, the healing other people need, and ask ourselves as a culture, you know, how we need to change and reinvent ourselves in order to overcome that whole dark legacy.
Well, I would like you to speak a bit, if you would. This would be the crux, in a sense, of the infrastructure here at Alchemy of Light, being that it's focused on the exploration and celebration of consciousness and how we feel and think, and our consciousness in the broadest sense, in how we choose the behaviors that we choose, would be absolutely primary in this. And how do you perceive, from your observation, how one might go from committing a genocide, or from a victimization of genocide, to a perpetual state of inflicting genocide? And how do you see that working out in the consciousness of people? What would you see as perhaps one of our greatest challenges as a human species, without pointing fingers, but as a species? What is that place in our psyche that needs attention, and of what kind?
Well, you know, that's quite a big question, but I think that one of the ways into that for me is always to look at how human beings are placed in situations where they're expected to either cause harm to each other or look the other way and to be part of that. Now, I've met people who worked in Indian boarding schools, who worked in all sorts of places where children were being harmed. And even today among churchgoers, when you try to talk about how their money is being used to cover up these crimes, to, you know, pay for lawyers to get it, to help the perpetrator get away off from any accountability for this, even when you confront people with that, the attitude is kind of a detachment. It's like they're dissociated. They can't see a connection between what they do in their own life and these crimes. It's like they feel like they're a little bubble somewhere, unconnected to these things. And it's a real, I think in psychology they call it cognitive dissonance, where you know, you have to go through a jolt, an awakening, where you realize, you know, I've been part of something that's causing harm to others. I've been causing something that's actually harming me, but I haven't realized it. And it's that personal, I think it's that taking personal responsibility for our own actions. That's the first step towards spiritual awakening. And, you know, that's kind of generally how I approach a lot of these things.
Mm-hmm. Are you still in an active ministry in the? Well, actually, are you still in an active ministry? And if you are, do you continue to address these issues within the Commonwealth on this level?
Yes, as a matter of fact, more and more of the work I'm doing is speaking to my own people. I mean, Native people have been a big part of it for a while, but more and more I've been addressing, you know, the European and the Christian culture that a lot of this emerged out of. And I do have an active ministry. I don't consider myself a big C Christian or anything. It's hard to put a label on where I'm at right now, but definitely it's finding the commonality between people, the kind of the natural law that binds all of us. The Mohawk people call it the Great Law of Peace, that unites people regardless of their beliefs or their position, and it operates from that common ground. So when a lot of the services I do, the work I do with people, kind of begins from that, finding the common ground we all share, and around three basic issues: the protection of our children, the protection of Mother Earth, and the defense of our liberties, all of which are under attack more and more in our society. So it's something I found that one of the ways I've been able to sustain myself is operating continually from that personal spiritual foundation. Because quite frankly, to try to take on this work is impossible unless you have that kind of grounding.
Will you please share with us about your, in brief, however it feels comfortable, your experience in the church itself? You were ordained as a minister, and then as a result of speaking out about the practices in the residential schools, you were then delisted, defrocked, kicked out of the church in a most ungracious way. And I wanted to, in that light, what inspired me about your story is that your pursuit of Christianity and your particular alignment with what you felt the message of Jesus was. Would you please share with us a little about that? I think it segues with the ministry that you are now engaging.
Okay. Let me say, first of all, that people can... We did a documentary film a number of years ago called Unrepentant, and it's posted online. It's had, you know, literally millions of hits. It's won a number of awards. It's posted along with a lot of the evidence of what I'm talking about at a website, hiddennolonger.com. And in that film, and, you know, I go into a fair amount of this, the thing that really caused me to become aware of a lot of this is the fact that there was... as I began to let more Native people speak from my pulpit on Sundays, I had an open pulpit so people could come in and speak about anything in their life, commenting on the Bible readings from that day or whatever. People began to speak more about these crimes that they had witnessed as little children, the things that had happened to them that were so horrible. And I began to let them speak freely. I was warned in no uncertain terms by church officials that I shouldn't do that. I was told that the Native people were just making it up. I mean, this was before any of the lawsuits had begun in 1996, so the churches were free simply to deny all of it. But what happened eventually was I discovered that the church had been selling off Native land that their missionaries basically had stolen to all sorts of big logging companies, including Weyerhaeuser, which is a big Seattle-based American logging company. I wrote a letter about that to the church, and within a week, they started speaking to my congregation, to people on my board. They started kind of a smear campaign among people in my church, claiming that I was mentally unstable, you know, the usual kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And within a month after that, I was just summarily removed from my pulpit. No notice, no review, nothing. Just out. I was told that unless I agreed to a psychiatric examination, and retraining for a year without pay, that I'd be defrocked, I'd be thrown right out of the church. That was really bizarre because I hadn't done anything. They said they could point to nothing I had done. They were just suddenly demanding this from me. I had two small children at the time, and my wife, Anne, was actually approached by church officials and one of their lawyers within a few weeks, saying that if she wanted to leave me, they'd pay for her divorce. And they eventually did do that. She got custody of my kids. You know, my whole life just fell apart, and it was deliberate. The church engineered all that because they were very afraid of the stuff that I was turning up, which eventually was used against them in court. So, I mean, the very fact that they were going to that extent said, look, there's something much deeper they're trying to hide. They wouldn't do this against just any minister they didn't like. There had to be, you know, they spent $250,000 throwing me out of the United Church. So that was pointing to something much bigger, and in fact, it was the way that led me into all these deeper issues.
In your ministry, the place I would really love to explore is how you saw Jesus and the part of Jesus that inspired you to the ministry itself, and how that has been a consistent thread in your life as an advocate from, you know, working with the underprivileged to the ministry to the underprivileged to the continuing exploration of how we can now continue to unravel some of the bigger challenges that are encroaching upon us. It seems an increasing rapidity, though. I wonder if it hasn't always been this fast and we're just waking up. It's been a very steady campaign of genocide, and the smallpox blankets of the 1700s have seemed to potentially have evolved to these chemtrail blankets that now, you know, are seeded in rain all manner of killing agents on to the entire planet. I mean, the genocide campaign has been going without check for a very long time, and it, if it weren't for people who respond to the calling of their soul, as you have, we would have, you know, self-expired a long time ago. I don't think we realize how important every single voice is, and I'd really love to highlight that in this interview, because we're sharing a lot of the heavier side of it, but at the same time, the reason we're able to be here and share this at all is because of the dignity of so many people that have been sharing it throughout the ages, and that this is our opportunity now to carry it forward and take advantage of the opportunities that the cosmos lend now to absolutely arrest this once and for all. I mean, it seems that it's coming to a head in a lot of ways from my perspective. Do you share that?
Yeah, very much. And, well, you know, to start with your first question about the part of Jesus that spoke to me, I mean, ever since I was a kid, you know, it was not only the sense of friendship with the man and who he was and continues to be for me, but his whole practice, not simply his words, but his practice was aimed at the people who were shut out, who were trampled down, the ones who were abused and taken advantage of and murdered legally. And he stood with those people, and he basically said, what you would do to them, you do to me. He interposed his own person between the ones who would be harmed and the people coming after them. And that example is something I always tried to follow. I simply tried to do that in my church. I said, this is a sanctuary, as Jesus himself would do. Welcome the lost and the suffering, and lift up their burden. That's always, for me, was the basis of what I was doing. And, you know, he was also a revolutionary, you know, in his time and day, just like people are who kind of follow in the spirit. He said that, you know, a society where there's a few on top and a lot of people suffering, it's not right. And I used to try to say to people from the pulpit that if you really love according to the way that Jesus loved, then you're not going to have a society where there's that kind of injustice and suffering. And so I was always motivated by that, and I would... you know, I found it was interesting work with Native people. They always identified very closely with that. In their own traditions, they have a legend that Jesus actually came among them before the whites ever showed up. And I found that again and again among Native people. They have that that relationship with Christ that predated the Europeans coming to this land, which kind of throws out the whole missionary notion that they were bringing the gospel to the natives. They already understood Christ, and they often refer to him as a woman. So these are things, you know, I learned, and I realized that, you know, my whole kind of way I had been raised was kind of put on its head, and I began to learn that there was something bigger going on. We're part of a much bigger drama of, you know, trying to bring that light into the world, and when you do that, you cause a lot of people who are have a vested interest in profiting off, you know, the abuse of others, you get them upset. And there's a great price to pay when you try to apply the teachings of Jesus to the world, not just in a church, but in the whole world. You know, it can get a lot of, it can get you in trouble in a big way. And I've found that. But at the same time, there's many people yearning for that message. You know, even the people who were getting rid of me in the church, I could see a lot of guilt in their eyes. They knew that what they were doing was wrong. But they were frightened, you know, they were frightened of a lot of things. And so I just realized more and more how that message is just as alive as it ever was, just that, you know, the teachings of Christ.
And where do you see us now in the conversation of the genocide and the eugenics? Can you talk a little bit about the universality, a little bit more about the universality of the eugenics and how it actually is bigger than the indigenous people,
yeah,
not to marginalize any particular group suffering, but to bring in the universal conversation again? And can you share with us a little bit more of what you've discovered in how all people are targeted? And if you know, what is this? What is the perfect genetic makeup? I mean, who's spared in this? Do you have any clue?
Well, I can give you, you know, some of from my experience. First of all, you know, the reason I mentioned that about Christ and his teachings is what I realized about Christianity, you know, official Christianity, is historically it was a deliberate subversion of Christ. The creation of the Roman Catholic Church was really the creation of a new entity. It had nothing to do with Christianity and Jesus. It was the Roman Empire with a new religious symbol put on it. I mean, the Pope himself, the title he uses was the title of the Roman Emperor, Pontifex Maximus. The symbols, the way, I mean, more people have been killed in the name of the Christian Church than any group in history. What does that have to do with the teachings of Jesus? Nothing at all. And I realized that what we call the Church was, in fact, the main mechanism for genocide all over the world and conquest. It basically said, if you don't agree with the teachings of the Catholic Church, you're not a human being and we have the right to kill you. And that system of genocide started as far as over 1,000 years ago when the first pope said, if you kill in the name of the Church over and during the Crusades, you're absolved from all sin, that in fact you'll go to heaven quicker if you murder in the name of the Pope. That idea was transplanted all over the world, and that's what the missionaries and colonists did here on this country too. So it's a very old practice in Christendom, which is different than the Christianity. Christendom is this corporation which has caused governments, authorized governments, to do this all over the world. You know, if you look at any of these crimes, you scratch the surface and there's, you know, this tradition of Christendom justifying it all, profiting off it. I mean, you know, the first fur trade companies in North America were owned by the Jesuits. The Jesuits set up the schools where these children were worked as slave laborers to death. You know, I mean, it's this horrible history, and yet there's a big blindfold over people's eyes. All these people are going into the churches thinking, you know, that it has something to do with God. It isn't. It's a corporation that hides behind lies, and I think more and more people are waking up to that fact, though. And when you talk about the universality of this, you know, right now I'm working with people in seven countries who've all suffered at the hands of these church corporations, and we're uniting those people now. So, I mean, it is becoming more and more everybody's story. It isn't just about one targeted group. It's something that affects all of us.
And, well, the common theme as well is the chosen ones. There's supposedly some few people that are the ones that are the right ones, and in whatever generation that is promoting the genocide to the mind that's not yet mature enough to discern the consequences of murder is whoever the going thing is. Like, in we have several genocide campaigns going on right now, the ongoing genocide of the Palestinians. Over there, the Zionist Bible says, you know, the right people are who? I mean, we still don't really know, but it seems to be everybody who's not killed, or it's a curious thing who the, quote, chosen people might be at this point, because the ongoing slaughter in America here continues, the indigenous people, but the poor. I think that the poverty is the most blatant Holocaust of humanity and virtually all of the planet when you look at the cost of poverty on the environment and things that are wasted along the way in the poverty consciousness and the poverty reality. So we have this this tight-knit genocidal campaign of poverty and starvation, and then the outright genocide, the very blatant murders and the ritual killings, which a lot of what I read in your book in no longer was very graphic descriptions of what the indigenous people endured in that in those schools, and so much of it sounded just like a satanic ritual. For example, yeah. The young boy who's raped by the nun who gives birth to their child, who's then made to witness the murder and dig the hole for the grave of the child, and then dressing. It just goes on and on. It just like right out of the satanic ritual handbook. And this might just lead us back to the Vatican, correct?
Oh, very much. You know, as a matter of fact, that a lot of the work I do now is with documenting how these things are going on today. You know, child trafficking is part of this campaign we're involved in exposing. And it involves the churches. We know that over 100,000 children go missing in America alone every year, that child trafficking is an accepted thing. You know, as a matter of fact, there was an article in a newspaper called Rock Creek Free Press out of Washington, D.C., just 2 years ago, and it had the CIA admitting that for at least since the 1970s, they were involved in child trafficking all over the world because they use it to the child sex trade to blackmail politicians and do that kind of thing. So, I mean, this kind of thing is really quite common. It's an underground industry, but heavily protected by judges. There was recently in Belgium a child trafficking ring exposed that involved senior judges and even United Nations representatives. And you often find the same pattern. In my home province of British Columbia, there's over 500 missing Aboriginal women, and these people are targeted because, you know, traditionally they were clan mothers. They had title to the land. But it's continuing genocide because it's, like you said, targeting groups for extermination. And, you probably know about the whole vaccine thing. They're, still to this day, in all over America and Canada, welfare agencies will tell poor mothers that they can only continue to get benefits or see their kids if they agree to be sterilized. You know, it's out-and-out population reduction, and I think that's part of the bigger agenda here. I would say there's two things that motivated a lot of these crimes. There was an agenda behind it: population control and mind control. You know, they were testing out all sorts of methods in these Indian schools and other places that they now try on the whole population about how to control people's minds and how to depopulate them. You know, that's all about long-term control, and I think it's very much at work now as we speak.
Well, you speak more about how you see the mind control apparatus, and focus on the vaccine conversation, if you'd like, a little, because the vaccine conversation has infiltrated the consciousness to the point that people themselves, without being threatened, will just get a vaccine. The voluntary, it's almost like voluntary genocide, and I don't mean to sound harsh in the sense that, you know, people I love go get vaccines. They believe that yeah. is a positive thing to improve their health. And, you know, I just had to love them anyway, come to some place where the conversation of soul, in that everybody is making their choices to live their stories for the reality that they've chosen to come here and participate in, that is really not my business to judge. And I really, right. I had to grow up a lot about that. But still, we can speak about the reality of the fact that vaccines are absolutely laden with poisons. Just as ephemerosol, the mercury that is in all of them is a known toxin. And where science will take us down the road, these are slow killers. These are things that do not come out the day after you get your vaccine. These are things that accumulate in the weakest parts of your body and will mature down the road in some very stressful times. Stress is a really kicker-offer of all those weak places. So these are slow-killing agents. So they're going to be a long time in the process of the human, as long as the human can endure this kind of treatment, which is another conversation altogether.
Yeah.
But
A couple of things on that. Like, people should know, first of all, that about 5 years ago, there was a patent that was approved by the U.S. Patent Office, and it was for miniature microchips inserted in vaccines, and these have been out for at least 5 years. Propagated by big pharmaceutical companies. So, in fact, these vaccines do contain microchips. Now, what they're for, people have different ideas about, definitely to monitor people. There's other ideas about that. But an example of how big pharma is behind a lot of this, you know, big pharmaceutical companies have been using churches for many years to test out their drugs in exchange for money and that to the churches. They test out drugs regularly on people in Catholic orphanages, you know, Indian boarding schools, all of this stuff. We're working with a group in Ireland where hundreds of children died because of being used as guinea pigs by Catholic priests, you know, at the behest of these drug companies. Big Pharma is one of the biggest lobbyists in America. They heavily fund both the Republican and Democratic parties. And, it's one of the reasons I think Romney is so against Medicare or anything like that, because it's all about profits in many ways. And an example of that is, do you remember the swine flu scare that happened a few years ago? The Novartis, one of the biggest pharma companies, came out last year. Their top medical officer admitted that all of that scare was fabricated, that it was just designed to boost profits, which happened, over $12 billion profits to the big three pharma companies from that swine flu scare. He admitted that less than one-third of the people who normally die from flu died because of the swine flu. And, they're saying right to our face, yeah, we lied to you. It didn't really happen. And yet all the governments colluded with them, getting people so afraid of swine flu that they all lined up to get this thing. So, I mean, we really have to never believe. I think there was a Washington journalist called I.F. Stone. He said after 40 years in Washington, he said, every government is run by liars and nothing they say should ever be believed. Well, I think that that's true about any big corporation, including these churches.
Well, in the conversation of run by liars, this is another challenge that we have of our time, because we do know that the governments lie and the pharmaceuticals lie, companies lie. And, you know, I feel like in a very understandable way, the Commonwealth is lost in a sense. Well, who do you believe then? And where can you find grounding in a society? And this leads to, perhaps Ken will maybe get there, what you're up to now with the tribunals and the common laws and the natural laws. And then we have all these, it's like a collision of agendas or something going on with a bunch of liars that dominate the media, that dominate governments, that dominate corporations, that, you know, lobbyists are basically running the country. And we have a sense that we know that, but the head in the sand seems to be the popular option, or pick your head up. And more and more people are picking their head up, but they don't know what to do with that. You know, like, okay, yeah, I'm seeing it. Well, now what?
Well, that, you're right. That's exactly the problem. People are aware that there's something really bad, that their so-called rulers are criminals, that they're being their lives are now threatened. But what I hear from people is, it's not that we don't know these things. What's the alternative? What can we do? Now, you know, some people have said, like friends of mine, they've stopped paying taxes. Okay, they've withdrawn from the society. They've held on to their rights in the face of this, and they've even gotten local police and sheriffs and that to back them. You know, to say, yeah, we're not going to do any laws that are unconstitutional, that kind of thing. But on a bigger scale, one of the reasons we're setting up, and I should explain to the listeners, for many years we've been operating this tribunal that's been documenting these crimes against humanity. What we're doing as of October 15th, just in 10 days, is we're setting up online a common law court all over the world. And we're starting to post the evidence of these crimes online so people can be, in effect, the jury. The whole world can be the jury, although we do have citizen jurors we've sworn in to kind of come to a judgment about what they're going to look at. This is about crimes by the, you know, churches, governments, all these things we're talking about. After a verdict is brought in, we're then going to say to the people, what is the sentence that you would like to see? What would you like to see happen in your community to make sure these crimes don't happen again? So, for example, people in Ireland have said, well, we want to make sure that priests are not operating under a law unto themselves, that they be licensed so that if they harm a child, their license can be taken away. We want the wealth of the church used to help the victims, you know, that kind of thing. And so it's really an exciting process because what it's saying is it's in our hands. You know, under common law, we have the right to arrest people who are harming our children if the police don't do it. If the courts don't rule against these churches, which so many times they haven't, then we have the right to bring in our own verdict and change our society from the bottom up. And that's what's exciting about this. It's giving people an option saying you don't have to rely on these corrupt politicians who are often paid by the very people we're accusing. We can do it ourselves, and that's a way to get people to wake up and to take this action. So we find this is starting all over the world. I was just in Europe this last month helping to organize that, and everywhere I go I see the same thing. People are waking up and saying, I want to be part of this.
Well, can you share a little bit about how common law works? And, just start there, please.
Well, common law is just something that we're all, it recognizes a basic fact about existence, and that is we are all born with what the founding fathers in America called unalienable rights. You're not given rights by a government. That's an old Roman idea, which the church operates under. Roman law said that the ruler gives you rights and they can take them away anytime they like. That's the law in Canada. Parliament gives you rights, they can take them away. In America, there's an idea that, and it says that right in your Constitution, Congress shall enact no law that violates these fundamental rights. They recognize that just a law brought in by government doesn't take away anybody's rights. You can't do that. But the rights are only real if you practice them. And freedom of speech is only real if you get out there and use it. What common law is it recognizes, it predates all these other laws. It says there's an inherent way people are with each other where we don't harm one another. If somebody is harming our children, we take action to stop that. There's an old saying in common law that the law shall bring harm to no one. So when judges or governments or churches are acting in a way that's harmful to the people, that's a violation of common law, of what we call natural law. And a government that does that doesn't have moral legitimacy anymore. Martin Luther King used to say that. He said, laws of man that don't square with the laws of God are illegitimate laws and should be ignored. So that's why they did civil disobedience. That's why they disobeyed the laws segregating blacks and whites in the southern states. You know, we don't have to obey laws that violate what we know in our hearts are our inherent rights and dignity as human beings. So that's the basic idea of common law. It's that the citizens are the law. We have it within ourselves to practice that.
And how would one go about finding that? You know, it seems like we all know those in our heart, and yet in our common reality, we have been led down this road of fictitious assignment of validity according to written words.
Yeah.
And these entities, this power in one of your recent publishings, this thing, the spirit thing that has been a dominant force in the manipulation of the human species is really big on words. You know,
yeah.
They write these incredibly wordy things, and we have all been conditioned from birth that these wordy things are actually real. And that
yeah.
they matter. And you know, what you're suggesting is that because we feel something is right in our heart, that is actually more real than those incredible libraries full of words that we mostly don't understand.
Right. Well, The idea is that the law, the government, everything emerges out of ourselves. It's not imposed on us like an alien force. And in fact, here's a perfect example. When you go into court, the judge will say to you, do you understand the rights I've described? That saying actually means not understand, but stand under. Do you stand under my authority? That's what he says. That's the hidden language in the legal rhetoric. So what you're saying is yes. By saying yes, you stand under his jurisdiction, and he has power over you. Well, no one has power by natural law over anybody else at all. And so the minute you agree to that, you agree to a legal slavery. When you're represented by a lawyer, represent means to take you and fashion something else that looks like you, but it isn't actually you. It's like the term aboriginal. Aboriginal means not of the original group. Indians are different people under the law than they used to be. You know, and that only happens because we go along with this false notion that there's an authority over us that we have to obey. No, there isn't. Only when we step into that jurisdiction is that true. So what we say is, well, we don't recognize their jurisdiction. And here's an example. Whenever we hold vigils, or sometimes we even walk in to churches and stand there peacefully, the police will show up and tell us to leave, and we say, no, we're not under your jurisdiction. You're here on common land that's owned by all of us, and you are a peace officer protecting our rights. You're not private security for this church, so you don't have the right to come in and tell us to leave. They always back down at that point. The police always back down, because they know we're right. But it's only when you're aware of your rights that you can act on them.
Well, that, I think, is the bottom line. And that, to me, is a major part of the education campaign that we're ready for. Those are the, you know, some of the guidance, those are some of the answers that I feel we're all asking, you know. And then they work better when we... when more of us are educated and we stand together, you know, because these people that are paid by our taxes are doing their job, right? They're going to do what they can to throw us out, to beat us up, to all those things that they're paid to do, because that's their paycheck plus all of their own personal soul lessons that are entwined in that process. So this is a time I feel very passionate about bringing this educational part to us, because we don't even learn about these laws. You know, we call them laws. Everything laws. You know, there's so many laws. There's Vatican laws and just your literature, papal laws. And, you know, it's a really challenging thing to untangle. In its essence, it's very straightforward. And in its... enactment, it's not, because we are definitely entrenched in these fictitious laws that we have, you know, given lot of power to over the years.
There's a simple way to remember this. Something is lawful when it's morally correct. Something is legal when it's just a statute brought in by the government. There's two kinds of law. There's statutes, which a government passes, okay? They pass a law saying you can't jaywalk. That's a statute. But beneath the statute, there's what's lawful. And your inherent rights of being able to speak freely, associate with who you want, do whatever you want as long as it doesn't harm somebody, all of that is more powerful than statute law. So when a statute violates that common law, you can ignore it. And if they try to arrest you for it, they're in violation of your common law rights. And, you know, judges recognize that as soon as people stand up and defend those rights. So... I think behind it all, what we have to recognize is that there's a spiritual reality at work, and that is there is, and my personal belief is that for a long time on this planet, there's been operating a force, and, you know, there's different descriptions of that, but it feeds spiritually, parasitically off our energy, and it has to keep the human race enslaved mentally, spiritually, in every way. That's one of the functions of religion, is that it keeps people in that state. Dependent, thinking that truth is outside themselves, that truth is brought to them by a religious expert, rather than it being within themselves. All of this is designed to get us, it's like a spiritual form of vampirism, really. It feeds off our energy. What more and more people are doing now is reclaiming that energy. They're just turning away, and that's all we have to do, turn away from these institutions and these authorities and take it back. And that's really the heart of our power, and I'm seeing that happen more and more.
Talk a bit more about this spiritual energy and how you see that, and how this is connected to the uniting of the work that you're the people you're working with now? And I know another big question. Forgive me.
They're important questions. And most interviewers don't ask them, so I appreciate this chance to talk about it. I've seen this at work. I've on a number of occasions I've been involved as a minister with exorcisms, and this entity definitely has the power to occupy human beings, to take over their minds. I've seen it at work in the extent to which governments and churches seem to have the ability to do that in a big way to people, control people's thinking en masse. I even think there's technology at work now that the U.S. government has, the U.S. military has. Well, I've had psychic friends of mine who've actually seen these facilities in the mountains of Northern California. They're actual psychic weapons that can be aimed at groups and individuals. Now, I don't mean to say that to get people scared or anything, but I think that we have to recognize that these things operate, and they only are successful by feeding off our fear. I mean, they operate primarily through fear, because as we know from 9/11 and all these other incidents, when fear is at work, the human brain, the higher mind, and the reason and all that shuts down, and people can be controlled without thinking. So I think it operates that way. But at a more basic level, it operates as well by our conditioning at a young age as children. And this is what I think is getting to the heart of the matter, the reason so many children are so regularly abused in churches. And, you know, it's epidemic when you look at the level of child rape and everything going on in the world. It's deliberate. It's a way to traumatize people so that they will obey authority. Because if you've been traumatized at a young age, even if you're not physically or sexually harmed, you're emotionally battered in our culture. You're told at a young age, you know, the natural joy and spontaneity and intelligence of a child is denied. They say, no, you can't be like that. You've got to be like this. That's what the school system's all about. The way parents are taught to condition to raise their children. They're afraid of their own children, whereas in traditional cultures, it's the opposite. Children are elevated. They're seen as sources of wisdom. You know, they're closer to the Creator and to truth often. And that is not honored in our culture, because it's based on this method by which people are enslaved at a young age to fit into a hierarchical society. You know, and that's what's really at the heart of child abuse. That's the purpose it's serving. And so when we break that and we get people to awaken to that, we're really threatening the basis of the whole pyramidal culture that we live in. And they know that. And this is, you know, the rulers understand that. That's why they do everything possible to divide and conquer us all the time.
Keep that fear pumping. You said a good thing. The fear disables our connection to our higher mind.
Yeah.
And then makes us easier to manipulate and then act without thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a very good way to say, a very important segue to how we as individuals can begin to reclaim our sovereign mind, our own connection, begin cultivating the connection to our higher mind and actually begin thinking again.
Right.
You know,
exactly, yeah.
the rationale there. The exorcisms and these sorts of things that you are familiar with, how do you see this spiritual energy? Does it have a form, or is it a conglomerate? Is it just in your experience? How do you identify it in an exorcism? How did you know when it's gone? You know, and what's the medium that you sense there?
Well, I can tell you with it's both applies to individuals and groups, and there's kind of a group. As a matter of fact, I'll mention in a little bit about the exorcism I did outside the Vatican in Rome. That the next day was followed by a tornado. And I'll mention that a little bit. It was quite something. But with individuals, the way it manifests is people who are in that state of possession are not themselves. You can see it in the rise. They're sad and depressed and controlled. A typical method you use, and I've used this with people, if you come up from behind somebody with any kind of sacred object, you know, from any culture, something that's been blessed, something that symbolizes something very sacred and holy in that culture, the person will jump as if they've received an electric shock, literally. They will see the object before without even seeing it. And I've had people yelling at me, get that thing away from me. You know, I mean, there's clues you can pick up like that. When the person is liberated from that state of possession, they are a very themselves, and by that I mean happy, harmonious, intelligent, open. You know, they have a natural kind of harmony going on that is missing when their energy is literally being drawn away by something else. And so I think this entity can take many forms. It's spirit. It's not flesh and blood. It takes, you know, it occupies. It's like in nature, they're called symbionts, you know, symbiotic organisms that feed off one another. There is a parasitical entity which doesn't have power by itself, but it feeds off ours and can take our form. It can take the form of anything around us. But once we recognize its nature, I'm at the point where I can almost spot it. I can literally spot it now in people when it's present. And, you know, so that's true. Now, what I mentioned before about institutions embodying that too, the Vatican is kind of like the main embodiment of this thing. And when I stood outside there, I was in October 2009, I did a ceremony in Vatican City for all the children who died in Catholic schools. And when I stood there, I expected to feel very kind of overwhelmed and intimidated. In fact, it felt like there was nothing there. Literally, there was nothing. And there was this kind of shell behind which there was nothing. And I did a ceremony in which I called out the spirit of death and lies from that place. And, you know, it was like a traditional exorcism ceremony. The next day, this tornado hits the center of Rome, and for the first time in 40 years. And that same week, for the first time in the press in Europe, Joseph Ratzinger, the Pope, Pope Benedict, was named as having signed letters to American bishops ordering them to cover up child abuse. So that came out. And the first stage of the exorcism, there's three stages, the naming of an entity. And the naming of something takes away its power because it's out in the light of day. The second stage is the telling it to depart, the banishment. And the third stage is its replacement with some other energy. Well, those first two stages we've done already. We named it, you know, then all this stuff came out, not accidentally. The naming of the crime came out all over the press, all over the world. The banishment ceremony we did the following year. And since then, we've seen incredible things happen, including cardinals within the Vatican even coming to us with information. People who don't like what the Pope is doing. Like, there's real fissures developing all through these institutions. The final stage is happening, you know, in these weeks, and it's the replacement of the spirit of falseness with something else. And this is why it's all everybody's responsibility, because it's only when people assert their natural selves that we can replace these parasitical institutions and entities with ourselves, with our natural human spirit. So that's something we all have to do, and it's part of the work we're doing.
Well, that's really a great accessible formula, and one that we could apply at personal level and also become more aware of in our reality, because we're all witnessing things that are not serving humanity, whatever it is, you know. And so we can all name that. We can call it out. We can say, you know, the ongoing genocide of the Palestinians is not serving humanity, and the banishment would be the reckoning of whatever the Zionist agenda is to see the last Palestinian take its breath, basically, and then replacing it with a vision, with a reality of a true humanity throughout the region that would be able to reckon in a responsible way with the suffering, to take responsibility for it. Because I think one of the conversations that kind of creates a bit of curiosity in me is this idea of the New Age or the Golden Age, and it sometimes is presented like, oh, we'll flick the switch and then all this is going to be just fine. And maybe it is, I don't know, but I really feel in my own experience that it's probably more a process that, you know, we don't just stop killing, we don't just stop these suckers, we actually mature into a more natural state. So to allow for the process, I think, in the replacement of what we're going to assign now as our new sovereign being or some sort is a good thing to sit with, at least, you know, if that's your calling. So tell me how, please elaborate more about what it is, this next phase, and how are you seeing the replacement, and a little elaborate a bit more on our replacing it as individuals, our personal responsibility right. in reclaiming our natural state, and how, as wherever we are, that we can make a difference.
Well, yeah, this is really important now because it's kind of an answer to a lot of these crimes. Just first of all, on an individual level, you know, anyone who's been through a 12-step program goes through this same process. You name something, you're you could call it a confession if you like. You're honest with yourself about your own condition. That's what we do when we name these crimes. We're honest about our human condition, about these crimes that have been done in our name often. The second step, banishment, well, in any 12-step group, that's what you do. It's a constant struggle. I mean, it takes hard work to overcome a personal addiction. It takes even more work to break away from these addictive, destructive institutions and ways of thinking in that. But in the final step, it's almost like all three are going on all the time. It isn't a linear progression. But definitely in terms of the replacement, it can take many, many forms, and it's all about people asserting what they know is right and decent in any situation. So, for example, you know, you mentioned about the Palestinians. It can be about any group. It can be about anything going on in our society. We say, okay, we're not going to have this. We're not going to say that we're going to hand over our taxes just to these institutions causing these crimes. We're going to take that money and reinvest it in our communities. We're going to use it to build up the resources of our community so we can help one another, so we're not dependent on these centralized institutions. I mean, that's kind of an example of replacement. It happens on the individual and the social level both. But the important thing to understand is you can't do it just once. It's got to become a whole lifestyle and way of looking at it, where we see that our purpose, you know, I think a lot of this is rediscovering our purpose in life, because most of us don't have a sense of that. We just pay our taxes, do our jobs, well, we raise our kids, and we can't answer the most basic question, why am I here? But all of this is allowing us to see that we do have a purpose. Our purpose, and in many ways we're in a final battle here for humanity and our planet. Our purpose is to recover, reclaim ourselves, reclaim our world, reclaim our power, so that we can have a future. And we look around us and we see what's at stake now. So I think that that's ultimately what replacement is all about. It's reasserting the things that were taken from us, you know. So I think that it often comes down to that.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I really appreciate your spirit and your clarity in that. And share with us what you're doing with the tribunal, and in particular, to finish up, where you see the next step with the exorcism of the Vatican, because that is a fantastic testimonial, and we all can see that there has been major shakeups, and that it is also a response to a universal yearning for truth, you know. It's interesting, I was doing my research about the resurgence of the Christopher Columbus challenging the story of, you know, the myth, and I realized that the dates that a lot of that stuff started to come out was in the early 90s, at the same time that you came out with the beginning of your research. And I've been noticing these cycles, and it seems like there's a universal energy that goes on within us, that even though we're paying taxes, maybe we're just doing our jobs and, you know, doing our best to keep our head above water, there's something inside every one of us that is pushing on these issues, because in our moral bodies, we know that there's something else, you know? Yeah. I just find that so fascinating. I'm very interested in that. So I'm really so grateful that you're here sharing your story from the active putting into place. You're on the front line of inserting these ideas and moving these ideas and bringing them all to all of us so we can see actually manifest what these ideas are. Your work is just such a gift to us right now, Kevin. I am so grateful that you are doing what you're doing, and I'm really grateful we can share this, because this is really all we really have to do right now in a big way.
I appreciate that. And, you know, one thing that might be of help to people listening, a lot of this can seem really formidable, you know, even thinking about taking this stuff on. I think my story is an example of what the miracles that can happen when you're persistent. I mean, I was just one minister living on Vancouver Island, and I just stayed at it over 20 years, and look at the results it's had. Well, if 100 of us did that, you know, just think of the consequence. We have to be persistent in this. And, you know, when you talked about the work we're doing now with the court and that, it really is a way to say to people that it's only through persistent action and broadening. It's like a ever-widening ripple going out. It brings us in touch with more and more of us, and we realize all along that it hasn't happened just to us. It's happened to all of us, and we're recovering our common story. And I'm continually encouraged by the people I meet. I see people waking up all over our planet, and it's happening quicker and quicker. There's this sorting out happening spiritually. And it's just an honor to still be alive, to be able to be part of that. And I say that to my daughters now. They're in their 20s, and they're beginning to kind of wake up themselves to the things that have happened to them as young children, you know, when we were broken up and I didn't see them for a period of time. They saw now that it's their story as well, you know, and so, I mean, just in our own families, when that happens, it's encouraging, and I think it shows that somebody once said that it doesn't really happen, what happens to us individually isn't a problem, even if we're killed by this, because our spirit and our ideas find new bodies in which to live. And I think there's an eternal mind, an eternal spirit that keeps resurrecting in each new generation. So I don't doubt that we're going to come out of this. It's just we're going through kind of a dark time right now, you know.
Okay, please tell us about the ways we can learn more about the Common Law Tribunal on the internet that you've set up and the.
Okay. We're the main website for our tribunal. It's the International Tribunal on the Crimes of Church and State, and the website is www.itccs.org. itccs.org. We post all of our announcements, the progress of the court, all of the evidence up on there. And like I mentioned before, our other website with our film and more of the evidence and that I've gathered over the years is hiddennolonger.com. So that's itccs.org. hiddennolonger.com, and you can write to me, hidden from history one, that's the number one, hiddenfromhistory1@gmail.com.
Thank you, Kevin. That is very an auspicious opportunity for all of us to learn about our true history and the repetition of the genocide that continues. I think that it's really helpful to learn our history. I feel like one of the main components of mind control and why it maintains such a hold is because we aren't taught history. You know, as soon as you put together, wow, genocide is what founded the colonization of this continent, that's a very different story. And then it makes it a lot easier to look at things like the geoengineering, the chemtrail programs, you know, these things that we find unbelievable, that how could governments be doing that to their own people? Well, these governments have only been doing that to people.
Exactly. And that's the power of knowing history, because once you see that it's been happening to all sorts of groups, including our own ancestors, you see, well, it's not that surprising they're doing this. It arms us now to deal with what we're dealing with today.
Exactly. And when I still want to hear a little bit more about what we're replacing this with in your perspective, because we've done in your work with the exorcism of the Vatican, part one and part two, I'd like to hear a little more about what your vision is, how we're replacing this, we'll just call it a dark spirit entity.
Yeah.
That's...
You know, well, as the entity leaves, that becomes more apparent. In a way, I often say to people, it's hard to talk about that or imagine it this side of our own liberation from that spirit. Because once we are free, the natural truth in the universe will come to us and we'll know what we need to do. So I don't want to lay out too much of a blueprint because to some degree it's tainted by the residue, if you know what I'm talking about. But I can tell you that definitely what it involves is not just that spiritual liberation I talked about earlier about people who are freed from possession, but you know, within society it means about living in harmony with the earth. It means about operating communities that are self-sufficient, that aren't based on international trade and the monetary system. It involves withdrawing from those systems, living in harmony with the earth and one another and all creatures. And human beings do that naturally. We have been brainwashed and perverted by living in this industrial system, money-based system, where everybody's out for themselves. I mean, that's not a natural order at all. And frankly, we'll see society changing, as it does all the time, from the grassroots. As soon as people lose their dependency and their mental conditioning to have to defer to these authorities, which are, frankly, in a state of possession. Like, I watched Obama and Romney debating the other night, and these guys are like little kids. I feel sorry for them because they're so controlled themselves that they don't even know what they're not even addressing the problems facing their own people, their humanity. Because they're so caught up in this old way of thinking. So it's not to those people you look to. You know, it's not to your local priest or anything like that. They're a part of the institutions are fallen. We are rebuilding from the ground up, and that's kind of the message we need to keep taking out all the time.
I appreciate that. And it is very interesting to just come to terms with the fact that our systems are collapsing and, you know, to be able to put our head around that, even if we can't imagine what that means. In a way, it's just so ominous to even ponder, but it still is the bottom line. And our scene here in America, the politics, it couldn't be more blatantly lost in terms of any kind of future. And it's even within people that I know who are followers and believers of this, they're shaking their heads. You know, so there's a big question mark hanging over now. Well, what is this? And who are they? You know, it's just the game turning over on itself, which is great, actually. Yeah. It's a great thing to be alive at this time to see, wow, we can change the page now. And and that is the gift of our time. And so we are coming up to the last 10 minutes or so here by my clock, and I would really like to offer you this time to elaborate or offer any information, things in your world of events coming up that are really important to include in this interview.
Well, like I said, I really urge people to keep updated by going to itccs.org. That's where a lot of our updates are posted. But I also want to make an appeal to anybody listening because, you know, the way this can start in your own community is to find out more about your neighbors and more about threats to children in your own community. You know, these things that go on are happening as we speak, and we need to take action right where it starts. I mean, there's a woman, for example, in Albany, New York, who every Sunday stands out in front of her Catholic church handing out information about what we're doing, saying, you know, there's a law in the Catholic Church ordering priests to cover up child abuse, you know, or they'll face excommunication. I mean, people in the churches need to know these things. And she says, stop giving money to the churches. Well, that's created incredible, turmoil in Albany now because the churches are all talking about it because of one woman standing there every Sunday. You know, that's the kind of thing we can all do. So don't think that it's beyond you. All of us can do something. We can begin to create that ripple of consciousness and awareness. You'll meet other people that way. There'll be a little cluster of justice forming around you when you start doing those things regularly. So I really urge people to take action for themselves and not wait. You know, that's how this work I've done has always happened. I just went out and did it, and I meet more people, and we keep doing it. And, you know, that's the way it's fueled. So I really urge people to take hope. The more you read about, you know, from our websites and hear this show and that, and pass around the word. We survive only through grassroots action and support from the people themselves.
Mm-hmm. Is there a resource? I think that hearing these stories, knowing these stories of the activism is really helpful. Is there a source where these stories are compiled or anything like that?
Well, there are. They're all over. I mean, I wish I had a huge staff where we could do this regularly. I'm going to be trying to do that. Those kinds of stories, I do make an effort to try to get it up on itccs.org more. But if you have your own stories, I mean, the only way to do it is to go ahead and launch something like that, because these stories are all over the place. I've got dozens of examples that I could give to people, but they all have to do with people taking that action. I mean, my friend Ellen in Bellingham, Washington, she went out and went to the local U.S. Army recruitment office and handed out information on depleted uranium to these guys who were signing up for the Army. In the course of that, she met soldiers who were draft resistors, people serving in the Army who handed out information to other soldiers about depleted uranium. She was charged, and the U.S. government tried to get her stuck away in jail for a year, but she fought it and won in court. Very inspiring stories of people and just in the communities doing that kind of thing. So, we'll do our best to get that kind of thing out. But I think the best way is for people just to do it themselves and then share that knowledge with each other, yeah.
That's great. Yeah, it's really inspiring to hear that. And for both the people who are getting on the edge of their seat, which there are so many that I know, and I'm reflecting the questions that are coming to me because I'm taking on my part, and people are saying, well, how do I find out what my part is? And it's part of the mind conditioning dissolving, I think. It's a good thing to just allow that to unfold.
Yeah,
however,
Well, I can tell you, too, and people should know this, the more effective you are, the more the smears begin on you. And I've learned this, you know, often people will broadcast my stuff and then they'll get a phone call. Oh, but did you know that he does this and that? And it's just designed to get people doubting what they're hearing. The divide and conquer techniques are very sophisticated, so that you'll get opposition. And it's all designed to get people to not trust each other. But we see through that all the time. We say, stick to the issue, stick to the crime that they're perpetrating, not any mistakes we've made, you know, and differences we might have, but stick on the issues and keep uniting people on that basis. That's the only way we have to counter that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because the smear campaigns and, you know, we all know stories that have impacted our consciousness radically. I mean, in my youth, I watched John Lennon get assassinated, and, you know, those things leave a mark on you. They definitely make a very subconscious seed that, whoa, if you stand up and say anything, you're going to get knocked out. And when you realize that your soul lives on, it doesn't really matter if your body gets knocked out, then you're starting to see the contribution you can make from a whole new light, you know?
That's right,
It's very inspiring.
That's right. And I hope that, you know, we're able to get together when you come up in my part of the woods, because I often say, you know, people, it's when you sit down and meet a person in the flesh that you can really get active, and that's what I often say to people. So, yeah, I hope we can meet soon.
Well, thank you. I look forward to this journey. My goodness. Oh, it's right on the waves. Next week, I'll be actually en route. So there you
Good.
Go. And
well,
I will definitely.
Email.
I certainly will, Kevin. So thank you so much for joining us here on the Alchemy of Light broadcast. We have been speaking with the Reverend Kevin Annett, Eagle's strong voice, and his fantastic work with the International Tribunal into Crimes of Church and State. That is ITCCS.org. You can also learn more about the outstanding work he's put together exposing the residential school genocidal campaigns that have been active in Canada at hiddennolonger.com. And I am Jamil Graham, your host, and thank you. Often, Kevin, at this point, I offer gratitude and a prayer of sorts in my own little version of it. And I wonder, would you like to offer that for us, acknowledging the ancestors and all that good stuff?
Yes. Thank you. I would like to just summon our ancestors now and all forces of light to stand with us, especially in memory of the children who have passed on, who look to us to come home, to have their story told, and for all the future children who we're protecting and who we need to stand as a great shield around. And I ask for a blessing and protection on all of us as we carry that sacred work forward. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, good people, until next time, take good care of yourselves and take good care of each other. Bye-bye for now.
Do you mind if I come in? I know how long it's been. I was out for a run when the storm came on. Thought you might let me in. You look a little surprised. I can see it in your eyes. I'm dripping wet and I bet I'm the last you expect to see you stopping by. And now I am taking calm. and the downs and in between. You ask me to tell you what was my favorite part, and I answer you, taking comfort in your warm skin. Time and time again, find comfort in your arms. Feels like heaven every time. Calming words and a gentle smile tells me you've been waiting for me to quiet all my fears. Patiently moving forward, now it's time to be a little more than yesterday, and I come closer to hurts or has pain. makes me forget I never became Moonstruck, kind of famous. Kiss me the way that makes me forget. Got bills to pay, the turn of everything electric. Softly sing along, so neighbors don't hear. Oh, yeah. What's ears are sounding so familiar to him. Something in his head makes him sound, and his heart makes it sound. Something in his head makes him sound, and his heart makes it sound. And that's when he's gone full circle. Thank you. Here we are today.